Good evening. My name's Michelle Brown, and on behalf of the Centre for Human Resource Management in the Department of Management and Marketing in the Faculty of Economics and Commerce, I warmly welcome you to this 24th annual Fernanda Lecture. This is a really special event for us, and it's really delightful to have so many people from both the practitioner and the academic community join us this evening. Before introducing the speaker, I wanted to provide you some of the background to the lecture and a little bit of information about Orwell Fernanda. Orwell Fernanda was an early and very eminent industrial relations scholar at the University of Melbourne. He was born in 1890 and began his association with the university in 1909 as a student in the law faculty. He joined the newly established Faculty of Economics and Commerce in 1926 as a part-time lecturer, and in 1954 was appointed the head of a newly formed Department of Industrial Relations. This was a very significant appointment. He was the first head of an industrial relations department at an Australian university. He retired from full-time teaching in 1957 and continued on a part-time basis until he retired in 1969. He died in 1985. The focus of his research was on the conciliation and arbitration system. Fernanda had met Henry Bournes Higgins, who was the first president of the Commonwealth Court of Conciliation and Arbitration during World War I. Higgins had advised Fernanda to take up the study of the newly emerging system of industrial regulation. He contemplated this advice for about 10 years and then devoted his academic work to exploring the activities and role of the Federal Commission. His primary focus in that research was on both the economic role of the tribunal as well as the protective functions of the tribunal. He was very interested in the role of the tribunal as a way of dealing with social problems and also very much supported the role of trade unions. He was a very prolific writer, and his output was impressive by the standards of the day as well as by contemporary standards. So, for example, his first journal article was published in 1928 in the prestigious American periodical, the Quarterly Journal of Economics, and his last article, which was published in 1969, was in the equally prestigious Industrial and Labour Relations Review. He also wrote 11 books, the titles of which have been rotating on the slides in front of you. So for almost four decades, Fernanda dominated the industrial relations field in Australia. After he died in 1985, the family set up a trust at the University of Melbourne to fund an annual lecture in industrial relations. The Centre for Human Resource Management is proud to be the custodian of this annual lecture. Each year we invite a distinguished figure from government, business, the union movement or academia to present a lecture on a contemporary issue in industrial relations and human resource management to an audience of practitioners and academics. Rotating on the slide behind me, you also would have seen the names of people who have been Fernanda lecturers in the past. You'll note that all of the names only appear once. Being a Fernanda lecturer is a once-in-a-lifetime honour. No one can deliver a Fernanda lecturer more than once. Before I hand over to the Chancellor to introduce our speaker, I just wanted to go through a couple of housekeeping matters. There will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the presentation. We ask that you use the roving microphones to make sure that the lecturer and all of the audience can hear your questions. Also, at the conclusion of the lecture, there is a reception. Barbara will be joining us for the reception, though, so there will be an opportunity to ask additional questions or interact with her in an informal way. There are drinks and nibbles in the courtyard. If you go out the back and to the left, there's a delightful, secluded plenty of drinks and nibbles in the courtyard for you to enjoy. You'll also see in the lobby that there is a little bowl for business cards, so if you'd like to be kept informed of future Fernanda lectures, please leave us your contact details and we'll put you on the mailing list. I now invite the Chancellor to introduce the 24th Fernanda lecturer.
Dean, Professor Isaacs, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the university, can I extend to you a very warm welcome to the Fernanda Lecture, which is a major event, as you've seen, in the university calendar. I begin in our customary way by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, who are the traditional owners of the land on which this lecture would take place. The Fernanda Lecture was established, as you've heard, in the memory of Orwell Fernanda, a former academic at the University of Melbourne and one of the leading figures in industrial relations scholarship in the early decades of the 20th century. Although I am an alumni of this faculty, I have not had the pleasure, unfortunately, of having been lectured by him. I wish I had, particularly bearing in mind that he knew Henry Vaughan Higgins, who was, in one way or another, a bit of a hero of mine. And if you ever read about his biography and how he came to become involved in industrial relations, it's a fascinating, fascinating account. In any event, each year, as you've heard, a distinguished figure from government, business, the union movement or academia is invited to present a public lecture on the contemporary issues in industrial relations and human resource management. Like so many University of Melbourne public lectures, it is a great opportunity for scholars and interested community members to engage on important current topics. This year is no exception, and the Fernanda Lecture will be delivered by Professor Barbara Pocock, who with respect is well qualified to give this paper. Her paper will, I'm sure, will speak for itself and confirm it, but nevertheless can I give you a sketch of her qualifications that also makes this point. Barbara is the director of the Centre for Work and Life at the Hawke Research Institute for Sustainable Societies at the University of South Australia, a centre which she established in 2006. Barbara was initially trained as an economist and has been researching work, employment and industrial relations for over 25 years. She has a wide range of experience in industry, having worked at the Reserve Bank, farming, trade unions and government. To round off her experience, she's also worked advisingly, I'm told, for politicians, and she's also been a mother and is a mother, which obviously was an extraordinary way of combining all her many activities. Now, Professor Pocock's past research includes analysis of employment relations, work, gender, vocational education, the regulation of industrial relations, unions and inequality. She has led the Australian Association of Industrial Relations Academics of Australia and New Zealand and is a board member of a number of institutes, including the Australian Institute, the South Australia Public Sector Performance Commission Advisory Board, the Strategic Council of Climate Institute, and she's on the board of the Festival of Ideas. In 2007, Barbara won the society category of the Bulletin's Smart 100 Australians. Professor Pocock has been occupied or held a number of fellowships. She's been a Dunstan Fellow, a Queen Elizabeth II Fellow, a visiting fellow at the International Institute for Labour Studies, and a visiting fellow at Ruskin College, Oxford. At present, with her colleagues at the Centre of Work and Life, she is studying the changing nature of work and its intersections with changing household and social life, with Australia as its primary focus. Professor Pocock is obviously not without a sense of humour. Her books include the wonderfully titled The Labour Market Ate My Babies, Work, Children and Sustainable Future, which was published in 2006. She also wrote Living Low Paid, The Dark Side of Prosperous Australia. Tonight's lecture promises to be a stimulating treatment of the changing meaning of paid work and social status in Australia today. So to deliver the 2009 Fernanda Lecture, would you please join me in welcoming Professor Barbara Pocock?
Thank you very much, Chancellor, for that welcome. I join with the Chancellor in acknowledging that we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people, and I also want to thank Michelle for her efforts in facilitating this lecture, all of you for coming, the Dean, and it's a particular pleasure to have Joe Isaacs here, I probably wouldn't be standing here if his work hadn't inspired me many years ago. So thanks for coming, Joe. I want to also acknowledge the memory and contribution of Orwell Fernanda and the many people whose names we've seen who have preceded me in giving this distinguished lecture. And it's a real honour to be here tonight, and thank you for being with me. A week ago, Crikey.com published something fresh from their fax machine. It was a memo from the newsroom staff to managers of The Advertiser, which is the Murdoch paper in my own city, Adelaide. The memo outlined a litany of problems at the newspaper that had led morale on the news floor to reach a very low point. It included abuse, bullying, threats of dismissal, a lack of reasonable direction and leadership, conflicting instructions, bans on certain words and subjects. It spoke of a lack of trust, conflict, news fabrication, unrealistic workloads, excessive hours and unpaid overtime. The memo said, and I quote, "We think it's unfair, unhealthy and unproductive to expect us to be in early, work late, eat lunch at our desk and not leave the office. We think that with better workload management, less wastage of time and more trust, we should be able to be both flexible and more productive." The memo concluded with the following words: "We love our jobs." What kind of love is this? And how does it survive in such a chilly, menacing climate? And that's what I want to turn my attention to. In this talk, I want to explore what work is to us as workers and as a society. When do we love it? And what does that mean? What's the upside of that meaning? And does it have a shadow? Does it have a dark side? I expect to be speaking for about 40 minutes, so I hope that you will have comments and questions at the end. And I have to acknowledge that I'm speaking at the edge of my thinking at the moment, which is always a dangerous thing to do, but that's to qualify when I don't know the answer, as you ask difficult questions at the end. But I really want to explore how such love and meaningfulness can thrive even in the midst of conflicting interests that always exist in a workplace, and at the same time must be controlled so that it doesn't lead us to act against our own interests, for example, by working ourselves to death. I also want to reconsider the concept of work as something that we want to avoid. Commonly, work is seen as something that we want to shirk. In seeing it like this, I think we've underdone the meaningfulness of work in our analytical research and in the practical activities of unionism and management. Work is not all bad, of course, and we've not paid enough attention, I think, to what makes it good and how to get more of the good. However, what makes work good can also make it bad for us. It can trap us in extreme jobs and for too much of our lives. And on the way through my talk, I want to introduce you just to 11 workers, but I want you to think about them as standing on top of 1,200 workers that people at my centre over the last 4 years have interviewed at length in focus groups or personal interviews. So I'm just going to give you 11 of them, not that you'll be relieved to know the whole 1,200, but I also am going to point to some large surveys which also exist and which the paper, which we've seen is on the website, makes reference to. I acknowledge my colleagues who've helped collect these interviews in the process of the last 4 years and the industry partners, including the Brotherhood of St Lawrence, the Victorian Government and other governments, especially the Liquor Hospitality Miscellaneous Workers Union and the Centre for Vocational Education Research. They've all sort of helped to collect this data over some years. I really want to explore a number of issues around the meaning of work, but I want to begin by just talking about the conceptual way we've thought about work. Academics, unions and employers generally have tended to view work as a bad. That is something most people would like less of and that we'd shirk if we could. Neoclassical economists have always characterised paid work as a trade-off against leisure. People choose between selling their time to employers or keeping it for themselves for their own leisure. Of course, there could be third choices. You might use your time for care, for contemplation, for responsibility for others. But those things don't enter this equation in the world of the neoclassical economist. It's golf or the office. And that says a little bit about economists. Unionism is also founded on the belief that work is a bad. It frames work as something that workers need to organise within to combat exploitation and poor terms. Unionism is structured to protect against work's unsafe or deathly consequences, against unfair terms at work, and to protect against malicious employers. In this light, much of unions' discourse is about how work is bad, employers are bad, and there's a perennial struggle around work and its terms. Thus, paid work is conceptualised in both academic theory and in practical life of unionism and employers as a bad thing, something we'd rather not do. Now, I'm not arguing that all work is good. It certainly has many, you know, negative sides, but it's not shaped by a structural inequality at its core, which requires organisation of employees in particular around. However, I want to draw attention to the fact that many workers see much in work that is good, and that many aspects of ourselves are increasingly made through work, and that scholars, unions and employers need to recognise that the dark side of work has a lighter shadow. And I want to explore what makes a good job and meaningful work. So, the meaning and practice of work, I just want to give you a bit of background, has changed a very great deal, as many in this room will be aware, over the last 30 years. The classical worker in the Australian social imaginary was and sometimes still is a particular kind of waged worker. He laboured physically, he sweated, he was in a manufacturing plant, a mine, on a ship, and he was in the union. His labour fits that kind of neoclassical economic conception of work as a necessary negative choice. An essential road to livelihood, his work offered few pleasures and many hazards to health, safety, and sometimes the welfare of his extended family and loved ones. Australia still has many such workers, and they're far from immune from injury and death. Something like 250 workers are recorded each year as dying on the job, and in fact the real numbers are higher than that. However, we've seen very rapid growth in the last three decades in the share of service sector employment, and especially in professional and managerial jobs. Hard physical labour is still with us, but in nothing like the proportion that it was just 30 years ago. I include in the paper several figures about this. A first one looks at the nature of jobs by industry, and it shows how that decline in manufacturing, in agriculture, in places like electricity production, with massive growth, really very significant growth in health, education, government, property, financial service and retail. And in terms of workers, very significant growth, 50% in the last 10 years in the proportion of associate professionals in the workforce, 41% growth in managers and administrators, 37% amongst professionals. So we're seeing really very big transformation in a shift to the white-collar professional end of the scale and a real shrinkage in the proportion that are labouring. There are still very large numbers of workers who earn their living through hard physical labour, about 1 million in construction, for example, but as a proportion of workers, they're shrinking. And the future is going to see more of these trends. If we look to the government projections for the next 5 years, they're all of those trends writ large into the future. Of course, much of this jobs growth is in casual and part-time employment, so changes in the form of employment contract and the quality of work also accompany these compositional shifts. Almost a quarter of employees, as many of you will realise, are casual workers, and they usually have, according to most measures of job satisfaction and views of job quality, much lower assessments, more negative assessments of their job quality. And they take less pleasure from their employment compared to permanence. While the nature of jobs is changing in terms of industry and occupation, however, our overall engagement with employment is very persistent and growing. Paid work plays a growing role in our lives and in our household shapes. Women's employment is particularly increasing, of course, while men's is declining. Young Australians start work early. Increasingly, they start in their teens and in a much higher proportion than in most other similar developed countries. Of course, their propensity for commodified communication via mobile phone and the construction of their adolescent selves through consumption is part of what's fueling that kind of labour market participation, but it's certainly quite a significant social trend, and it's affecting the lives of young people. And at the other end of the age spectrum, of course, we expect to work longer in our old age, with governments very keen to support and even to require this. raising the eligibility age for the pensions under discussion in a number of countries, and the prospect of supporting a growing number of frail, rather demanding baby boomers is terrifying treasuries around the globe. Many Australians are very keen to work into their 70s and they can't imagine not working or can't afford to stop. Others, especially those who labour more with their bodies, are looking forward to laying down their tools and heading for the back veranda. Between youth and old age, we spend a lot of time at work. Men are less engaged than they were in the 1960s, but women are participating much more and underpin an overall trend upwards in participation rates. Nearly half of women are part-time, but they're increasingly in paid work for the majority of their prime years. And once again, governments are very keen on that, encouraging single mothers, indeed requiring, I should say, single sole parents who are in need of welfare support to hitch themselves to at least part-time work when their youngest child hits seven. Some of this policy impulse is about minimising state expenditure on welfare, but some of it's about social inclusion, with work seen as the best and surest way to proper citizenship. So what are we getting from work, this work that we're increasing our attachment to? Well, most obviously, of course, money. And our need for money through work is in turn fed by the growing cost of living, as well as our compliance in expansive work-spend cycles, more work driving more spending, which drives more work. But robust surveys tell us that 60% of Australians would go to work even if they didn't need the money. In 2001, almost 60% of respondents to the Hilda survey agreed that they would enjoy having a job even if they didn't need the money. Only a quarter disagreed and the rest were kind of in the middle and had no strong view. Not surprisingly, professional and managerial workers had a higher proportion who would have gone to work even if they didn't need the money, but more than half of cleaners, labourers and elementary clerical sales and service workers agreed that would enjoy having a job even if they didn't need the money. So what else are we getting? And I want to discuss four things: a sense of efficacy, identity, contribution and or vocation. Secondly, social connection. Thirdly, the opportunity to learn. And finally, the positive spillover that workers believe they take home from work to their household. A great number of workers draw a sense of contribution and enjoyment from their jobs. For some, this is a feeling of realised vocation, a deep feeling of response to a calling, to a type of work, accompanied by a commitment to what they are doing. For others, this is a sense of feeling good about making a contribution or doing what they do well, whether it's painting a wall, pleasing a customer, caring for a child, growing a crop, making a bed, or teaching a student. Others just enjoy parts of their jobs. And I'll just give you one example. Portia is a midwife in Perth in a birthing centre. Her husband's a caretaker, and they immigrated to Australia just a few years ago. They have two young children, recently took on their first mortgage, and Portia's been working shift work for 27 years. It's a condition that's generally associated with very low, with significant health issues and significantly worse job satisfaction. Portia is a breadwinner and she says, "I love what I do and I'm really fortunate to be able to do something that I'm absolutely passionate about. I couldn't wish for a better job. The actual type of job I do is fantastic. It's just amazing." If I counted up the time she said fantastic in her interview, it would be multiple. She considers her job a precious thing in her life. She rides her bike for her short commute to work, and this bolsters her fitness, which she considers a very important aspect of her job. She has job security and decent pay. She values her professional autonomy, and she knows her shifts well in advance so she can plan her young family and their activities around it. And she's learned to value good managers very highly. For her, they are good communicators, they have an even temperament, they support learning, they're encouraging, and they are present. Portia's got a true vocation, a calling. She homeschools her children and she's religious. She meets Catherine Hackham's definition of a home-centred woman. Portia firmly sees herself, however, as a worker with a vocation, as well as a devoted mother. She sometimes feels torn, but predictable shifts, a short bike commute, her supportive colleagues, good management and enough resources, when she can get them, underpin her attachment to a job that she loves. She would not give up her job. She doesn't intend to give up her job for many years, although she may go permanent part-time if she can get the mortgage under control. She wants to work in a job that she loves and which extends her. And she illustrates a number of workers that many workers that we've interviewed in terms of her very strong interest in expanding her mind while she's working. Like so many other workers we've interviewed, Portia loves learning. I'm really into education, she says, right across the board, for herself, for her medical and midwifery students, for school children who she goes and talks to about her vocation, and for her own family. She says she loves working in an area I was trained to be in, that I have a love for, that I can actually practice all my skills in. As a midwife, you have so many basic skills, but then as an experienced midwife, you get extended skills, and if you can use that scope of extended skills and as an experienced practitioner, then you're very lucky. Case reviews and reflective exchanges with other midwives about her practice are opportunities she values to improve her skills and increase her competence. She's running a little research project on the side about how birth stools are used in her practice in the hospital that she works, hoping she can convince the other midwives that birth stools are a good idea. I mean, that's what you'd do, wouldn't it, as a shift worker? You'd run a small research project on the side. Her enjoyment of learning is not that kind of enjoyment of learning is not confined to professional workers. I'd like to introduce you to Kelly. She's 18. She works in a large retail hardware store. After 3 years, she's about to be made permanent in her job. She works in the timber section. You've probably all visited this store. She's a trade specialist, and she's very happy to finally have stability in a job where, after working in a range of very low-paid service jobs, she felt like family immediately after joining the firm. And that's all about the way she's treated. She works with another colleague called Sandy, who does what's called special orders in the same company. That requires a lot of product knowledge and a lot of patience because you get irate people like us on the end of the phone wanting to return things and get special advice over the phone. She's in her late 30s, so she's an older worker. Previously resigned from her job as a school assistant because she felt I actually wasn't smart enough for that job. However, now, she says, they make you feel like you can do anything in this place. You rise above a certain level. You've got constant training. All day I'm learning. It's virtually all day I'm learning. It's never boring. I need to be constantly learning because once I stop, I get bored. Being in a workplace with formal in-house training makes work very attractive to these two workers. Kelly's done all the online courses in the firm, and here's what she says. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to, but when I've cleaned everything up, I'll just sit down and I'll get my product knowledge up there, and I've done every possible online course, forklift driving, gardens, barbecue, special orders, tiles, roofing, everything that's there. Learning gives Kelly product knowledge and the capacity to assist work customers, the thing that she really takes pleasure from, but it also gives her power. She tells a story. I had a gentleman the other day wanting some timber cut, and I'd only recently learned how to use the docking saw. And he goes, isn't there enough males around here to do that? And I go, well, that's why I learned, so I can do it. And he goes, oh, well, it's usually the males. I'm like, well, I'm here. Do you want me to cut it or not? And I did it, and I finished it, and it was all done. And sometimes I like getting those customers just so I can stick it to them. Now, this is an 18-year-old, and if I could show you what she looked like, she's a very unconfident young kid. She's left school very early. She's a disadvantaged learner by anyone's categorisation, but she's really growing in confidence. She uses the word confidence repetitively in her interview through her access to learning, and she's hungrily consuming and making her job good through what she's learning. Kelly really enjoys helping customers. Now, just remember, she's in a retail store. She does no post-school qualifications at all. She finds it very, very satisfying. And she appreciates, along with her colleague, the fact that in this company, as one put it, family comes first. There's work and work, and family is family. This doesn't stop Sandy, for example, the single mother of two, from doing work after hours, dropping off merchandise to disabled or old customers who can't get to the shop, for example. They also appreciate the workplace takes account of their lives beyond work in its rostrings. Sandy's daughter's recently been bullied at school, so she's got special permission to come 10 minutes late, having walked her daughter to school and working 10 minutes late at the other end. These are small and modest changes in practices in workplaces, but they're very unknown and very difficult to achieve for many workers. Another worker in their workplace called Vince, for example, works in the tool shop in the hardware store. He earns half what he did previously as a machine operator. He's full-time, but he's very glad to no longer be working 12-hour shifts. He likes shorter hours. However, he would like to be using his IT degree. and he recently applied for a job and was knocked back in an IT firm and is sticking with the tool shop, but he was knocked back because he needs to go to church on Sunday, and in the 1 in 6 weeks when he'd be required to work on a Sunday, he wouldn't be able to do it, so he didn't get the job. So there's a whole lot of things about flexibility that really make a difference to these workers in valuing their jobs and finding them good jobs. As in so many other workplaces, these workers really enjoy the social aspect of their working lives. As Kelly puts it, if you don't feel that you're part of a group, even though it's only work, you will not want to go to work. It's a huge part of it. She and her colleagues stress the importance of relationships that work, and more, some of them are finding friendships at work. As one put it, this is Kelly, for me, I have a lot of friends here, and they're friends outside of work as well. Most of my friends are probably from here. I've made some really close friends here, and they'll probably be friends for life. Turning to another occupation, school assistants, also relatively low skill, we find exactly the same kind of discourse about friendship and relationships. One of the Wendy's working in a school assistant role in South Australia, and she says, the people I work with are my family. I got married 2.5 weeks ago, and most of my work came to my wedding over my family. Not that I have a poor relationship with my family by any means, but they're the people that are there. I'm there with them every day. Sometimes I work with these people more than I'm home with my husband. So they are the people that get you through the good times and the bad times, and they're the people I want to celebrate with. I think we really underestimate the resilience that the workplace gives to workers as they do confront crises in their life beyond work. I've interviewed a number of workers, for example, who've been through very difficult breakups in relationships or violent situations, and they have been saved, as they say, by their relationships with their colleagues. Other school assistants we interviewed don't socialise much at all with their colleagues, but they all agreed that their relationships with their co-workers were very, very important. And several had left jobs where the relationships weren't good. Catherine, for example, has raised 4 children. She now works as a finance officer in a school, and she speaks in similar terms about the role of social exchange and the pleasure she gets from exercising her skill. She says, I work with a great group of people. They're really family friendly, and I actually enjoy the work that I do. I've got a head for it, and I enjoy it, and I can get completely lost for hours creating an Excel spreadsheet. Now, this is flow. This is what the positive psychologists talk about as flow. Now, we think flow comes when you're playing the piano and you're a virtuoso musician or you're an elite athlete. This is creating an Excel sheet in a school environment. This worker is really using that language of total immersion in what they're doing. Catherine contrasts her experience, her feeling of flow, working when she worked some years ago for a major bank for quite a while, where she was not supposed to talk to people at the front counter, which she found impossible, and it was very them and us in the hierarchy, especially as a female, she says. It was just boss and slave. Catherine is studying for a degree. She's eager to increase her skills and their formal recognition, and she expects to have her degree by the time she's 50. So she's never going to use her degree, quite probably, in her school environment. But her appetite for learning, the weight she puts on positive relationships are really quite striking. Time is a critical element in all of this relationship building and human exchange, whether it's with patients, school children, customers or co-workers. Time is also critical to learning, and it strongly shapes workers' overall views of their jobs. This is very evident in a group of workers who are likely to grow very strongly in Australia in coming years, that is, amongst aged care workers. I'll introduce you very briefly to Arthur, Beatrice and Martha, in Queensland, who work in a very large not-for-profit aged care facility, visiting people in their own homes, showering them, helping them take their meds and visiting them. They love their jobs. They love seeing old and disabled people respond to a home visit, seeing them physically improve, helping them feel less lonely. They enjoy the autonomy of being out in their own car, and they talk about the personal pleasure of watching people's faces. Arthur's a 57-year-old who until 18 months ago worked as a safety officer on a mine, and he earned 4 times the $16.80 an hour that he now earns as an aged care worker. While there's much enjoyment to be found in these jobs, and these workers describe at length things they like, and we weren't asking them, do you love your job? This is all incidental to a conversation about the Certificate 3 training that they were doing. While there's a lot of enjoyment there, there are also really significant downsides. All these workers talk about the fact that they feel they're paying a price in lower pay for the fact that they like their jobs. They feel there's a discount in their pay for their enjoyment. as Beatrice says, that while she works for a church organisation, I'm not a charity. We're suffering, as are our clients. Arthur, Beatrice and Martha's enjoyment of the work is marred by two things, poor pay and low time autonomy. Arthur says, we never have enough time. I hate that time factor. I saw a lady this morning, she lost her husband a few weeks ago. We really connected. I had to say, listen, I've got to go, and kept looking at my watch. I was empathising with her, you know, and I felt upset that I had to be forced to go. I'm not blaming anyone, that's the way it is. They talk of having a clock ticking inside, one that's wound tighter and tighter, as every minute is accounted for on detailed timesheets. These are the people who'll be looking after us before too long. They'll be looking at their timesheet when we're telling them something really important. When we say, I was a professor, you know, it ain't going to matter much. You are forever trying to catch up, says Arthur, always managing time, calculating it, adding up the minutes and trying to get out and away from clients without seeming to hurry. What Arthur's describing when he uses that kind of language is a very classical kind of emotional labour. That's the labour, the cognitive work that one does to seem one way when one is feeling another. So you're controlling the way you appear to the people that you're looking for so that you appear listening and so on, but you're actually thinking, I've got to get in the car. All of these people have 30 minutes to arrive in the car, come in and shower, check the meds, get back in the car for every person they shower. So it takes the car, Martha says, it takes the pleasure off while we're here, doesn't it? Because we've all said we're here because we care for people, we want to help them, we want to get rewarded at the end of the day. We do get that, but there is this other side. So these workers with their internalised clock, which is set by the employer and by the funding system for aged care, are engaged in a classic form of time pressure overlaid with this emotional labour that they do. Enjoyment of the job, of course, is not confined to midwives, retail workers, people who are in the helping professions. However, it's extended, I think, to a much broader range of occupations. However, enjoyment of the job is not enough. It's the terms of employment that really are essential to allow that enjoyment to flower. And this is illustrated by one final case, that of Jeff, who's worked as a paralegal for many years. He's actually a plumber, but he loved the law, so became a paralegal and worked for many years as a paralegal. Now 63, however, he's returned to plumbing. And he says, it's about not being able to cope with an 100-hour-a-week job. This led to a life-threatening health problem for him and a triple bypass, and he wouldn't have survived, he says, if he had stuck with the job he loved. So he's back to plumbing. He's working 60 hours a week, big improvement on 100, he says, and a lot less stress. Jeff is one of many paraprofessional workers who are caught in a vice where the love of their job conspires with its greedy terms to result in long hours, poor health, and in the end, possibly, no life at all. The contest between the enjoyment of the job and the struggle for time is obvious. While paralegals can actually enjoy higher wages as a reward for their long hours and vocational devotion, others find their commitment is met by low pay in a kind of discount for enjoyment. Beyond identity and enjoyment of their jobs, education and social relations, workers also talk of the positive things they bring home from jobs to their family, beyond the pay packet. And there are a certain set of things that I think arise from this interview that really are recurring themes that are characteristic of a good job. And I've just run through those. Enough resources figures repetitively in conversation. Enough resources and especially staffing to do the job well. Flexible working conditions and predictable hours. Enough hours to support a living. The aged care workers really struggle to get enough hours to get a livable wage. Reasonable rather than excessive working hours. Supportive management and leadership, and that's a black box in itself with a whole bunch of things within it. Opportunity for personal development and skill acquisition, very important. Time to transfer knowledge to each other. Decent pay and job security. The significance of all of these factors is really shows up in large surveys of Australian workers as well over recent years. Unfortunately, this positive spillover is far from always present. When work is bad, people take home bad things. Children, partners and extended community relations, we know from survey results, are impacted by those negative spillovers. And there's a lot of international research about the negative spillover that comes from bad working conditions. I think the question of time is also a repetitive theme here. All of the workers I've talked about are engaged in, at some level, in a struggle for time. School assistants who say they're having to do more with less, retail sales workers who are having to work hard to find time to train each other and themselves, to offer customer quality customer service, which they like to do, midwives who want to reflect on their practice, paralegals and plumbers who just want reasonable hours so they live longer, aged care workers who have an internalised clock that constrains care. The time poverty in all these kinds of situations has three common consequences. Firstly, it affects the quality of service and the outcomes. Secondly, it restricts learning. And thirdly, it undermines job satisfaction. Enough time is critical to all of these things. So how can we get more good and build those good characteristics of work? And how should unions and employers be responding to these kinds of workers and their situations? Pay and job and hours, job security and hours security must be a significant part of this conversation, but they are very far from the whole story. Issues of respect at work, relationships with bosses, relationships with colleagues, workload, the management of time, skill development all figure prominently in their commentary about work. They know what a good boss or a good workplace is, and some can find one. Many have positive experiences of their work, and unions need to speak to these positive experiences rather than framing work as a bad that requires union protection. And there are also, of course, many challenges in this for managers. It's uncanny. It's a very uncanny experience to interview workers who work on the same organisation, almost in adjacent offices or wards, in a common policy and profit context, and have such very different experiences to talk about and evaluate their jobs very differently. They're in a shared workplace, but first line management makes an extraordinary difference to the way workers evaluate their jobs, this data would suggest. And I wanted to finally turn to this question about the dark side of good jobs. I've talked so far about changes in the nature of work and the fact that many draw positives from work, positives that we perhaps underattend and which we can better build on. However, before I finish, I want to consider the dark shadow, the dark side of some of this love for work. In the comments of these workers, we can see that they are realising themselves through their work, their skills and their relationships. However, what are the consequences of this expansive sense of self through paid work for the social state of not working? Are we starving the selves we make when we are not working in putting so much effort and drawing so much pleasure from the sphere of commodified labour? Ulrich Beck argues that work powerfully constructs identity in the 21st century, and he says where everything is work or else it is nothing. He suggests that we've replaced God with work. I think it's the third time I've mentioned God in this lecture. You'll think I've had a religious conversion. But some workers agree that we are overdoing work. When we launched the results of our 2009 survey of workers in July this year, they showed that despite the fact that 44% of Australian women work part-time at present, which is much more than most similar countries, a third of all full-time women in this large survey would like to join them and work less, even taking account of what that would do to their pay packet. This desire is very strong among full-time women who are mothers. This is not surprising when we look at how many of them say they feel rushed and pressed for time always. Not sometimes, not often, always. When we released this research, Stephen Lunn of The Australian talked to a professional worker and single mother of two boys, 9 and 7, to illustrate the story. He wrote how she admitted she was, quote, seduced by the fast-paced, high-level work in her large professional services firm. However, she decided to regain control of her life and reset her priorities, not least of which was to be able to meet her two sons at the school gate. She described the addictive nature of her job, and I quote, "The appeal of these places is that the work is great. It's exciting. It's challenging. I would love being out on a consultation, doing the work, being part of a team, working with other fabulous women. Part of the guilt I had was sitting there in my office thinking, God, this is great." Like so many of her professional... In her professional life, she worked long hours and was on call at other times. She employed a live-in nanny who drove the boys to school, made meals and helped with homework. But it was not easy. I was outsourcing all that and it caused me great anxiety. Eventually, with her health suffering, she decided to quit her job and take a pay cut. What she goes on to describe, we spoke by phone a week after the story ran in the pages of The Age. in the Australian. And she said that she'd the story was titled, the byline was "The Struggle to Juggle," that she'd recently been walking her young one of her young sons down to the park, and her son had turned to her with a big smile and said, "No more struggle to juggle, Mummy." She also received a phone call from one of her colleagues who said that she congratulated her on her bravery in admitting on the front page of an Australian newspaper that she had failed. So I want to end my contribution, and I developed this in the paper, by asking, what kind of world is it where we define not working as failure? What kind of universe have we created where you can become a master of the universe, whether you're a plumber or a very hard-working paralegal or a lawyer or whatever? You can enter that world of the master of universe, but what are we doing to the sense of self that is created by not working? So I want to make an argument for a greater attention to the practices of not working, of caring, and contemplation, whether it be artistic, gardening, whatever. I'm not being romantic about this. I'm not an unreconstructed hippie. But I think the really important thing is that as work grows in what it takes from us and what it gives to us, we shrink the other parts of our lives with important consequences for our social relations, not just in the household but in our community as well. And I particularly think this is a very significant issue for carers. I think that it's a very important question for women in particular. We have entered into the world of paid work on terms that it was always the feminist project to contest. We wanted to contest the terms of employment which are made in the male breadwinner's image, and we wanted to contest the unfair allocation of unpaid work at the same time. Both of those projects have failed. The resistance to job redesign in so many of our workplaces so that they can accommodate the different worker who may be a mother, may be a carer, or maybe someone who just doesn't have a strong attachment to working 35 or 38 hours a week. We've been unable to change the terms of employment. They increasingly create a new bar for workers in the workplace, and I think this is imposing very significant consequences not only on carers but on people who want to construct themselves in different ways. So I guess I'm asking the question of ourselves and our society about, we love our work, but it's in a rather tight conspiracy with a labour regulation system which is very weak around working time. And that's a very sad collision, because as long as you have enthusiasm for employment in a regime which doesn't regulate, for example, the total length of the working week in a meaningful way, especially in those areas that are growing in white-collar, professional, paraprofessional and managerial employment, then we see growth in the length of working hours, intensification of labour, and I think the consequences for us as human beings and the kind of society we want to make are very significant. Thank you.
There's now an opportunity to ask questions. There are two roving mics in the theatre, Van over on my right and Danielle on the left. So if you do something obvious but tasteful to indicate you'd like to ask a question, Greg, way up the back there.
Thanks very much for your very interesting and important analysis. I just wonder to what extent a peg on which you might hang the analysis could be the notion of the dignity of work, which is something that philosophers have discussed going right back over the ages. The notion of the dignity of work, as you know, is enshrined in the Constitution of the International Labour Organization. It's promoted by the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, by the European Charter of Fundamental Rights, and most recently, I think you were involved indeed in the Australian Institute for Employment Rights, which has tried to promote this notion of the dignity of work in an Australian context. Is that a relevant and worthwhile concept on which to build your novel ideas, Barb?
Well, yes, I think that the ILO's notion and attention to the question of the dignity at work and the components of the dignity at work is a very useful one. I mean, in the ILO, it's quite an expansive notion of what matters in the quality of employment. But I guess I'm also trying to argue for the dignity of not working. Mm-hmm. And I think that I absolutely agree that we need to work on a broad range of characteristics of employment, and that we over-attend to the question of pay, for example, and I think the ILO is trying to talk about job security and control of working time in its dignity of work recipe. But I think we also have to work on ways in which you can move in and out of employment with more dignity, without the loss of citizenship, without having to conceal on your CV that you once worked part-time. Yes, you are a man, but it doesn't mean that you aren't able to, you know, be a proper worker. So I think I'm trying to argue a larger picture than that. But, yeah, thank you for that, Greg.
Thank you.
Can't believe I lost the end of my speech, you know. It was so good. I'll get over that.
I just found it really interesting what you were just talking about, the dignity not to work. We hear a lot, particularly throughout the union movement, about equal pay for women and how while the legal minima are the same irrespective of gender, because women find themselves in part-time casual work, there's still a disparity. Would you be suggesting that that's maybe not the issue that people make it out to be, because as long as those women have dignity in what they're doing and they've got flexibility to juggle what they need to, what is your reaction to those arguments?
I think at the moment, because we have failed to renovate the care regime, which is implicit in the employment regime, we haven't shifted at all the unpaid work allocation between men and women, at least not significantly, at the same time as women have really increased participation in paid work. And we have failed to revalue many of the forms of employment that women enter. The labour market is greedy for the care capacity of the female labour market. And those women in their accounts understand that they're paying a huge pay penalty for being aged workers. Arthur is paying a huge pay, four times a cut in his pay, to do something he likes. They see that as very unjust. But I was speaking to Philippa Hall recently, who's just come back from running a pay equity system in New Zealand, and she makes the point, you know, the fact that those wages are so low is that those workers will take it. Now, what does that mean? They will take it because they have very weak labour market power. Their argument for pay increases is not BHP, it's the taxpayer, and the same in the aged care system. So this massive expansion of employment is outside a profit relationship, and a whole different market and a regime of exploitation shapes pay in childcare, aged care, and so on, in many feminised occupations. So I think pay equity is incredibly important. I think a good minimum wage system is vital to improvements in women's pay. And I don't think those questions are trivial at all. And I certainly am not arguing that because women like their jobs, you know, it's okay to get 84 cents in the dollar. Yeah.
Any other questions, comments? Danielle, do you have a comment?
I call myself an occupational psychologist. It's not a fashionable term nowadays. They call themselves organisational psychologists, which I think is a mistake, but that's another thing. I worked on a project on the employment of married women in industry back in the 1960s in the hosiery industry in the UK. And this took place in Leicester, which was at the time an unusual city in that married women went to work, and we had to interview managers in the hosiery industry, and they had a system which they called, by a rather unfortunate term, I think, concessions, but what it meant to is workers were allowed to come in late or leave early or take time off if family needs required it, and that sort of thing. And they adjusted what was a highly mechanised industrial system to accommodate to the personal needs of their employees. Now, that's a long, long while ago now, but it raises questions of management's understanding of the involvement in work which people have, which you've talked about so very well today. And it seems to me that an awful lot of managers don't understand those aspects of work. And this has huge implications, it seems to me, for the training which we give to managers, MBAs, so keen on optimising the bottom line and that sort of thing, that this kind of stuff doesn't very often get into their programmes. Can you think of some programmes that can be developed to increase awareness of the human side of work, which you've talked about so well today?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I personally think that a good manager makes a really extraordinary difference, even in a very oppressive environment. For example, in a large hospital, you can really see the difference. I mean, I'll just give you one small example of a woman in Perth who'd been nursing for 17 years on the ward. Now, this is, you know, the Perth labour market 6 months ago, very, very tight labour market. She followed her husband up to the mine where he took a job. The marriage broke up. She had a four-year-old. She comes back to her old ward where she'd worked for 17 years and says, I just can't get to work at 7:30 in the morning anymore. I've got to take a child to care. And they said go away. In the next ward, through the wall, the nurse says, no problem. What do I need to do to get you? I mean, it's so simple. It's so important, and this is in the presence of such a tight labour market, you'd think that it's impossible that it would happen. But, I mean, I think those things are not... They're about cultural change. They're also about change in supporting managers to make changes in the way they work, to recognise the fact that, you know, 4 in 10 of us who go to work on any day of the week have got responsibility for someone else, and we might have to go home at some stage during the day. I mean, they're not rocket science issues, but better training. And also, I think a lot of companies that are making change are putting in KPIs, measures of employee views, and tracking change and hitching bonuses and payment systems to it. And that makes a pretty quick difference.
We'll one last question and then we'll need to close.
Thank you. I'd like to ask about the idea of empowerment, for want of a better term. I work for a trade union for the last 10 years of my working life, connected with the outdoor workers in local government. And there was a CEO of one municipality who introduced a policy that any new plant and equipment that had to be purchased had to be approved by the person or persons who were going to use it. He was able to prove that that increased efficiency, it saved money, and it led to job satisfaction. And the people on the job absolutely agreed. Yet that never became a high priority. Can you explain why this is?
Well, you know, what a mug, you'd have to say, wouldn't you? I mean, I just think that's absolutely the case, that people's... There's so much evidence that taking power, the decision to the level at which the person is affected, makes an incredible difference to engagement in employment. That's a dopey manager.
Thank you very much for such an interesting lecture. I don't think there'd be a person in the lecture theatre who couldn't identify with what you are saying, particularly if you're in my age group and wondering, you know, why we love work the way we do and what's our identity going to be like when we actually leave work. So I found your sharing of the research that you've recently undertaken most interesting. I'd like to know the kind of questions that you're going to be able to answer from your, obviously, the survey data and the intensive interview data that you've got. But I think you've given us an idea tonight of some of the problems and are now looking for solutions to those problems and what the responsibility is of the unions, of society, and of employers in terms of their leadership in trying to solve these problems. So I don't think it mattered to any of us that you left the last two pages behind. You obviously know your respondents to your survey very well, and I particularly enjoyed the lovely anecdotes with your 11 individuals. So thank you very much for sharing your research with us, for taking the trip over here to present this lecture. And I'd like to give you a small token, and I've been told that this is from one of your favourite shops in Adelaide, so I do hope you enjoy it.
Thank you. So can you...
And thank all of you for coming. We'll have an opportunity to talk to Barbara Moore and with others outside in the foyer. Remember, as Michelle said, she's given me my notes here. Remind them, Maggie. Go outside, turn to the left, and there's drinks and refreshments. So please join us.